From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in February when a dozen middle school students attended a camp in Washington, D.C. The group of 11 to 13-year-olds worked with local artists who helped them produce a music video. The topic? Gentrification and diversity in architecture. And here is one set of lyrics from one of the students. Quote, I grew up in a place being gentrified, raised in Chocolate City, rehabilitized, hanging out in the streets of Eastland Gardens, where houses were built by Lewis Kay and Clyde Martin. The world can't appreciate their work. They seem infinitesimal, smaller than neutrons. The female architect is a minority, only 450, yet women are a priority. End quote. The camp called Hip Hop Architecture Camp was created by a Wisconsin-based architectural designer with the goal of introducing underrepresented youth to the field. In addition to recording their music video, the students also learned how to sketch and create 3D models using an online design tool. The founders say the camp plays an important role in introducing young people of color to the profession, especially considering recent statistics. Data from the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards shows that 2% of licensed architects identify their race or ethnicity as African-American. 90% are white. So what are the barriers to entering the profession faced by people of color? And how can diversity in the field be improved and increased? Also, if a greater number of diverse voices are included in the planning and design of cities, how will those cities look different? Those questions are the focus of a Reshaping Rochester presentation set for next Wednesday, a week from tonight. We get a preview this hour with our guests, including next week's speaker, who's on the line with us, Ashley Walton, project manager at Urban Design Associates. Ashley, welcome to the program. How are you?
Hey, I've been doing well.
And also with us in studio, Nana Ando is assistant professor of architecture at RIT and board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. Nana, welcome to you. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be here with us. Now, once again, let me tell you a little bit about the event next week. The event is next Wednesday night, and most of the events are for the Reshaping Rochester series are on Wednesdays, April 24th, 7 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium. That's at 1000 University Avenue, if you haven't been to Gleason Works. Now, the events in this series are free, but they suggest a donation of $10. They do want to make sure anyone who wants to attend can do so. So no required donation, just a suggested donation of $10. And registration can happen on the website for the Rochester, the Community Design Center of Rochester. It's rrcdc.org. So we're going to talk this hour about the subject of what communities look like, but let's just kind of start with the basics. And Nana, it's no surprise, it's no mystery. It is a very limited sort of narrow field, isn't it?
Correct, yes.
And how did you find your way into it yourself?
Well, growing up, I just loved to draw, and my sister suggested why not try architecture because most artists unfortunately starve. At least that's what she told me. And so I ended up going to the University of Notre Dame, and I just fell in love with the craft. And I was told that architecture is really a design for people and improving their quality of life. And that is what made me fall in love with architecture.
When it comes to limitations, what would you say is the major cost of having a field that is so limited, so lacking in diversity?
I think primarily we're talking a lot about exposure or lack thereof, and also the cost associated with architecture in general. So when you're in school, the supplies that architects need is inordinate. And what we don't understand is that it's kind of an upfront cost. So when you purchase that, you are essentially creating something that you can use for a very long time. But it's not sold to kids as this is an investment into your future. So we see that as an upfront cost that we just cannot afford, and so it becomes more of a deterrent.
A big barrier to entry.
Exactly.
Yeah, so as a professor of architecture at RIT, what's your student base look like?
Well, our program is currently a Master of Architecture only, so it's at the graduate level. We get more affluent students, international students. I mean, the cost to come to RIT is quite expensive, so we don't have the demographics that would be more of the minority-based, if you will.
Okay. We got an issue with Ashley on the phone, so we're going to try to get Ms. Walton back on the line in just a moment here, and we'll bring her back into the conversation. Professor Ando is in studio with us here, professor of architecture at RIT. So let's talk a little bit about what communities sort of look like and then what the societal cost is if you have a very limited field, for example. So let's kind of start broadly, and then we'll get more specific. What's the cost to not having diversity in a field like this?
I think what you get are pockets of society that become forgotten about or marginalized, if you will. So what I mean by that is when we're trying to solve problems for, say, low-income housing, it ends up being communities that we think about as primarily housing. We just need a place to put people. And we forget about the fact that people need to go to work, and how do they get to work? People need to eat. How do they get to the places they need to eat? And so when you look at most affluent communities, there's that recognition and that sense of what you need to live a full daily life. But when we look at communities of marginalized communities, if you will, it's primarily about housing. So a lot of what they need to have a full daily life gets ignored, and it becomes a much, much larger systemic problem.
All right. And do you think Rochester reflects some of what you see with that?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Being someone who lives in Pittsford, it's a very beautiful, affluent community, and it is very walkable. And then when you go, to be specific, somewhere on, say, North Clinton Avenue, where you see affordable housing communities where it becomes almost blocks and blocks and blocks of housing, and there's a dependence on public transportation to get to everywhere you need to go, that becomes a problem when the only source of public transportation comes maybe every half hour. So to get to work and back again becomes a problem. To go to the grocery store and come back again becomes a problem. And so there's a small ripple effect when there isn't enough thought being given into the urbanism of low-income housing.
Yeah, it seems to me that when you travel to other countries that have more robust public transportation systems, there is not an assumption that income is what drives people to public transportation. Whereas in this country, you know, if you can afford a car, you generally have a car. You agree with that?
Absolutely.
And so, so I think there's a couple of layers there, because if this country really does get serious about more public transportation, and maybe we will, maybe we won't. I mean, that conversation's ongoing. Mm-hmm. Could that change some of the dynamic? If we can get more people who could afford a car, choose not to use cars, you choose transportation, create more demand, more schedules, does that help? How do you see that?
That is a very good observation and a good question. So what I would say is, the first example is if you travel abroad anywhere and you look at the speed of public transportation, ideally it ought to get you there faster than your personal automobile. So there's a level of convenience for being in public transportation. In the United States, primarily, that is the opposite. So if I leave my house to go to work and I drive, it'll take me 15 to 20 minutes to get to work. If I decide to take the bus, it'll take me about 2 hours to get to work on the same road. So there's a thought process there that we need to actually look at how we mobilize public transportation to make it more appealing to the masses, or else it just becomes inconvenient. So the first thing we need to do is actually look at how we use our public transportation to make it more appealing, and then keep emphasizing that.
Do you see change coming in this country, in this community, or in this country? You kind of got a smile on your face there. Not necessarily?
I would say that I do. It is coming. However, it is coming very, very slowly.
Well, let me bring back Ashley Walton, project manager at Urban Design Associates, on the line with us, who's going to be here in Rochester as part of the Community Design Center series, the Reshaping Rochester series, next Wednesday night. First of all, Ashley, we've been talking about some themes about how communities are laid out and designed, and who benefits and who doesn't. Before we get back to that with you, why don't you tell us a little bit about the work that you do at Urban Design Associates?
Sure, Evan. So, I mean, a lot of what we do here is we like to consider ourselves community engagement specialists. So it's getting into these communities and working with them to come up with the plans that we see all over, and it's projects of all sorts of different scales, as small as cottages and as large as regional master plans.
And do you see the same kind of issues that we were just talking about with Professor Ando here in studio, which is that We've got a very narrow field. We know that it's 90%+ white in architecture, for example, and the efforts to increase diversity may be still relatively new. We can talk about mentorship. Do you see that narrowness in the field as having deleterious impacts, harmful impacts across communities in our country?
Absolutely. I mean, I personally have never yet been in a community engagement session where there were any other designers of color that I was working directly with, especially that were directly in my own field. And usually when we're coming into these different communities, they're communities of all sorts of different diversity. So we may be working with communities that are everything from a really strong mix to communities that are primarily white, communities that are primarily of color, communities that are primarily of different backgrounds and ethnicities. And often what people gravitate toward is someone who looks like them, someone who they feel that can share their experiences, and it gives them a new way to talk and a new way to engage about the communities that are their own. And so I absolutely think that people being able to see and experience people who have similar experiences, look more like them, can relate to them in that way, can change how they talk about their communities and how they talk about the planning process.
Hmm. Professor Ando, how often do you find other people of color in your field?
Very rarely, yes. Just like Ashley, I have been in multiple meetings where I am the only person of color in the room. And yes, people will gravitate towards you because there is that assumption of their shared experience, absolutely.
Hmm. So, actually, how do you see the answer to what communities, you know, how they would look different if we had always had more equity in terms of who makes up the people in this field? What would be different, whether it's Rochester or other cities and the outlying areas around these cities? How would they look different?
I think it's really difficult to say how cities would look different themselves because a lot of the basis for what's happening in our cities is so already formed by one focus, and everything from the fact that even when we look at a lot of our public spaces, they come from spaces that are primarily Roman, Greek. You know, we're looking at plazas, parks, public spaces. A lot of our planning principles come initially from those early planning principles. But something that I do think would be different, and that's one of the direct things I think would be different, is public space, how it's programmed and how it's used. You often run into situations where people of color don't feel welcome in certain public spaces, and that's something that we try to dig into a lot when we're on charrettes, planning workshops, where we're talking to people about what makes a space that they would want to come to, what sorts of programming or spatial design would they want to see, what elements of design would they want to see that would encourage them to come to and stay in these public spaces.
Well, I want to ask both of you a little bit more about your background, about what brought you into the field in the first place. And Ashley, yeah, I know mentoring young professionals and potential future professionals, especially young people of color, is a part of, you know, a significant part of your work. What did it for you? What made you want to be an architect?
I decided that I wanted to be an architect, and this is a bit of a preview, more of a preview than you might expect of my presentation when we're there next week. But I decided I wanted to be an architect when I was 12 years old. I was at the University of Tennessee Knoxville's Art and Architecture Building. I had been playing in the Youth Symphony Orchestra there, and we had our end-of-year party in UT's Art and Architecture Building. And I walked into that building, and I looked around, and I saw the drawings that were pinned onto the walls, and I saw two students building a large-scale model. And I had never thought about the field of architecture before. I didn't know any architects. I had never met anybody who did anything like that. And so looking around at this really amazing space, and looking at these students who seemed so engaged in what they were doing, I looked up at my mom and I asked, could I be an architect? And she said, absolutely, you can be an architect. And she set out immediately to find me people who could connect me and talk to me about architecture, which is something that I just never really experienced before.
Wow. Nana, what about you?
I'm not sure if I can top that, but I never really knew anything about architecture, literally till my first day in a class of architecture. And I just loved to draw. I knew that was my passion, and my sister just advised me again to just give architecture a shot. And I will never forget that first day in class when the professor said, architecture is and always will be about people and improving their quality of life. And to me, when we approach architecture in that sense and make it that personal, I think it resonates with people. And that is really what made me just fall in love with architecture.
Well, and Ashley, I mean, I assume it had to be really all-consuming for you, because my understanding reading some of your background is at first you wanted to be a teacher, but this became really the path for you. Did you ever waver from it?
Not really. I wanted to be about four things in my entire life, and three of them had to do with art, and one was a marine biologist, which completely separate thing, but that was a stint in the middle there. But originally, I wanted to be an artist, and from that, I wanted to be an art teacher. I loved the idea of talking about art and explaining it and teaching it to others. And then when I fell in love with architecture at 12 years old, I knew that that was also something that I would one day want to teach and talk about with others.
Reading from Joel, who writes to us to say, is the profession also mostly male? And is there a difference in terms of landscape versus urban versus, you know, sort of what we consider traditional architects? Let me, I'll start with Ashley on that. I'll ask both of you. Go ahead.
The profession is indeed mostly male. I believe right now the percentages are about, it's more than 75% male, if I remember correctly, from NCARB's latest NCARB by the Numbers. That's the National Association of Architecture Accrediting Boards. And so right now we're looking at less than a quarter female architects in the profession. APA, the American Planning Association, I believe they also have numbers out on that, which are also skewed male, but I do not know how heavily.
Okay. You want to add to that, Nana? Yeah.
Yes, it is heavily male-dominated and also essentially very white. So I have had the opportunity to work in firms of a size of 4 to 150. And across all spectrums, I was the only black person in all these firms. So again, it is mostly white and mostly male.
Okay. Yes. Talking about equity and design and architecture in particular, and what communities gain and lose by having a narrow group of people who are doing the work in this field. We're talking about this because that's the subject, in part at least, next Wednesday night, April 24th, 7 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium, the event for the Reshaping Rochester series brought to the community by the Community Design Center. You can register now if you want to do that, rrcdc.org. For the Community Design Center's website. The event is free. They do suggest a donation of $10 if you want to do that, and Ashley Walton's going to be there. And there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the specific work and successes. So, Ashley, you know, you worked on the 7800 Susquehanna Street Neighborhood Master Plan in Homewood in Pittsburgh, and at least one news source has called it a model of minority empowerment. So give us a sense for why that is. Tell us about that project and your role there.
That was a great project. I mean, that was one that was led by one of our firm principals, Megan O'Hara, and it was a project with Bridgeway Capital in Homewood that was working with a large, a big building that's a huge, a kind of an anchor in the community there that is a maker space, business incubator space that has recently started to be developed. And the area immediately around that building is something that could be considered pretty catalytic in that neighborhood for the growth of that neighborhood. It has some challenges in terms of connectivity. There's the busway that runs right behind it, which some people have some concerns about people going through it or making it more transient. But there's a lot of discussion about what that site could be and how it could benefit Homewood directly.
And now, what do you think the great lesson, if you're taking from a project like that?
I think the biggest thing from that project was the fact that the community engagement really came from people who were already anchors and pillars in their mm-hmm. community, galvanizing the community to come out for that. We did some community engagement work at National Night Out, which is a large community engagement event of its own, kind of bringing the community out on their front porches. There was a large cookout at one of the local Baptist churches, and it was a place where we were able to come with our maps and talking about the different things that we wanted to plan, the different ideas that we wanted to gather from the community. And one of the best parts about that for me was when a group of children came over to read the maps, and we were able to point out where we were on the maps. And the first thing that they gravitated toward was, oh, if we did it like this, then we'd be able to walk to school with more things happening around us. So they could instantly see the connection between the planning process and something that would instantly enable them to have a safer and more fun even walk to school, which was something that we instantly picked up on and were able to use as we went further through the planning process. So I definitely think that it was relying on those pillars in the community and relying on the people who were already there on the ground making it work to connect us with them so that we could hear the community's voice and what they wanted to happen.
But in this case, and I don't mean to sort of be dismissive of the general idea of including the community, but in this case, it sounds like you actually did it. And I say that because, you know, you brought up the term charrette. That's a term that listeners may or may not know, but Rochester has seen a number of them. There was one in Shalott not too long ago. And that offers the community, anybody who wants to be there, a chance to be there, offer input on design strategies, you know, sort of linking neighborhoods, all kinds of questions. And the idea is you get everybody involved. You bring people from all across the community, no matter what their background is, no matter what their income is, to the table. And you take some of that and you actually use it. Or there's different ways. It doesn't have to be a charrette. The issue I see, and this question is for both of you. I'll start with Ashley on this. The issue is every project now, they say that we want the whole community involved. Everybody says that. Nobody doesn't say that anymore. But the real question is, how do you follow through with that versus the kind of lip service that happens and then all of a sudden it's sort of status quo, same old, same old. Ashley, how do you make sure people are following through with that?
This is something that is really challenging in our work today. We often encounter communities that will have different organizations say, these people are planned out. You know, they've had a dozen workshops and, you know, 50 community meetings, and no one's ready to bring more engagement. They're completely planned out. And we're hearing that more and more because, as you say, community engagement, as at least in theory, is becoming more and more prevalent in all of these planning processes. But I think that part of what UDA, Urban Design Associates, looks for when we're following through with community engagement, we rely a lot on the tradition of community engagement that we have in our firm, which is started before community engagement really was a thing in architecture and planning in 1964 when Urban Design Associates started. And David Lewis, who's our founder, one of the things that he would consistently say is the reason why Urban Design Associates is called Urban Design Associates is because we're all associates in the creation of our places and in the practice of urban design. And so because of that, there's a lot of lessons learned that we have over 50 years of community engagement practice. And some of the biggest things with that were simplicity, asking simple, open-ended questions, focusing on regular people and their needs, having honest conversations about community benefits and cost implications, focusing on precedents and places people already know. I mean, these are all things that, like, you know, keeping local context in mind, these are all the types of things that we've been able to rely on because it's something that the firm has done a lot and that we have a lot of experience and practice in how to talk to people about it in all sorts of different situations. But I think the biggest thing is, then the biggest danger that planners can run into and that architects can run into is already assuming that a community is planned out, already assuming that, well, they're having so much community engagement that no one actually wants to give their input. I just don't think that's true. I think that communities always have input that they want to give, and I think if the profession can be honest with them about costs and benefits and what's practical, then there can be a realistic conversation about what can happen.
Here in Rochester, there have been a number of big, high-profile projects, whether it is Parcel 5, Rock the Riverway, a number of others. And I am not pointing to any particular project as a point of either pride or contempt on this. I'm just pointing out that there's a lot of projects. And what I tend to see, Ashley, is that there will be a release of designs to the public. And then they'll say, now we'll take public feedback. But the public generally feels like the cake is already baked. That, okay, you know, we've already seen all of your renderings. We've seen all the designs. Now that we know you're doing this, now you say you want to hear from us. You may move a brick or two, but it feels like the cake is baked, as opposed to were we involved from the start. Is that a fair distinction to make, or am I maybe off there?
That is a very fair distinction to make, and that is actually something that we encounter all the time when we go into communities for workshops. I know that something that we go into a lot is discuss, like, we'll come to a workshop and we will legitimately be coming to listen. We will have no preconceived ideas, but the question that we are asked the most consistently is, do you already have a plan? Is there already a plan that's, you know, already done that you're just not telling us about? Do you already have something in your back pocket? And the answer is consistently no, we really don't, because one of the biggest things is focusing on listening rather than educating. I think something we hear all the time in the profession is, well, you need to educate the client. You need to educate the client about this or educate the community about that. But if we go in with an idea that it's the community that are the experts and we are there to put their ideas on paper, it puts us in a different headspace and a different mentality of thinking, how are we going to interface and work with them?
Hmm. Nana, what do you think about that?
I think it's absolutely perfect. And when it comes to community engagement, there are really three things we need to focus on. One, it's about the community. So if you want them to be engaged, you go to the community. The community does not come to you. So if we're talking about a charrette or giving feedback or opinions, it is up to the politicians to go to the community and get them engaged, as opposed to saying we're going to have a session at City Hall at 6 p.m., everyone show up. That does not empower people in the community, because more often than not, they cannot even show up at those predetermined times. So it's absolutely about being able to go to the community to engage them. Secondly, as Ashley said, it's about listening and giving them the respect they deserve, right? They are your clients. It's about them. Ask them what they need. They know what they need, as opposed to politicians imposing their views and their wants on a community. So simply ask them. And last but not least, it's what you mentioned, Evan. It's predetermined choices. Are you coming with an idea already in mind and asking people to place dots on what they like and don't like? Red dots, blue dots. We've been there, done that. That does not work. So go in with a blank slate, listen respectfully, see what they need, and then design around that, as opposed to the top-down mandate, which always seems to happen.
All right, let me get a phone call from Tom in Brighton, who's got a question for our guests. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I hope my question is still on topic. My question is primarily centered on aesthetics. In my opinion, I hate to be negative about this, in the last, say, 70 years, there's very few buildings that I find, especially large buildings, that I would call attractive. Most of them, in my opinion, are downright ugly. I can't think of a single glass tower in New York City that's gone up in the last, you know, 70 years or so that I find attractive. In Rochester, yeah, I would say the original Kodak Tower was an attractive tower. When they added those additional things around it, the expansions, they're completely unattractive, I think. And maybe they're functional, but they're not very pretty. So I'm wondering, how could expanding diversity and inclusion among architects perhaps give us more aesthetically attractive architecture, and especially tall buildings?
Interesting question. Yeah. Thank you, Tom. Go ahead, Ashley.
I think this is about even more than including diversity in terms of, you know, people's ethnicity or backgrounds, but also including diversity of architectural education. It is the, like, architectural education right now is often geared at enabling each student to become their own mini, often called Starchitect. So small, like, architect that has a lot of, you know, flair, and they're their own, they're there to create their own sculptural piece. And that can sometimes take away from what are the things that people love about their buildings, what makes a building lovable. There was a studio that I had at my School of Architecture at Andrews University called Background Building Studio, and the entire intent of that studio was to create a building that would not be particularly spectacular in terms of standing out as its own building. It was either a mixed-use building that had retail on the ground floor and living residential on the upper levels, or a row house, something that was meant to be innocuous, meant to fade to the background, and just wondering how to do that well, how to create a street wall and an experience from the building instead of making it a building that stands out on its own. And so I think that it's including that diversity of perspectives in terms of what makes something beautiful, what makes something lovable, what makes something, why do we love a place or a building or a type of building? And I think it's including that diversity of perspectives that will help change the aesthetics of architecture into the future.
Okay, Professor Ando?
I think Tom hit on a really important point, which is that when architects design, sometimes it's always all about the building and not enough about the context. So if you're designing in a place, you really need to pay attention to the context and the tradition of building that has been established in that location. And do you try to follow that and adhere to that? And as Ashley said, create a lovely street that creates a sense of place, as opposed to every building being an icon onto itself. Because when you do that, you end up in Las Vegas and not, you know, a beautiful American Main Street.
All right. Thank you for the phone call, Tom. Listeners, if you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Our guests in studio, Professor Nana Ando, who's an assistant professor of architecture at RIT and a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. Ashley Walton is on the line with us, project manager at Urban Design Associates, and she's coming to Rochester next Wednesday for the Reshaping Rochester series. Her event starts at 7 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium, and you can hear the presentation. It is a free public presentation. They do suggest a donation of $10, and you can register in advance at rrcdc.org. Got some email to read from our listeners as we talk about equity of design, and we'll talk a little bit more with our guests about the work that they're doing in their various fields and how it impacts maybe future generations. We're going to talk about recruiting and mentoring and bringing new people into the field as well. So let's get that break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, there's a famous image of beating swords into plows. And with that in mind, the authors of a new book called Beating Guns say that we can learn a lesson from history. The authors are the president of Red Letter Christians and also a Mennonite pastor turned blacksmith. They're in Rochester talking about their movement to beat guns, and we'll talk about it Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking to guests about their work in the field of architecture, and it's a field that's very white, very male, but there is some effort to change that. And when it comes to some of the choices they've got to make, I want to read an email from a listener who describes himself as a current urban planning student at UB. And says, hi, Connections team. Question for the guests. Have they ever been in a position where they have had to implement something that violated their principles of equity? And how do you balance job security and values in a field like this? Interesting question from Brennan. Ashley, I'll start with you.
Well, I think that the answer to that question isn't quite a yes, but it's definitely a partially. Fortunately, I am enabled to work at a place that value is a really important part of what we do. The values that we have about equity and about planning are definitely a very important part of what we do. And so the vast majority of our projects conform to that. However, there are some projects, especially projects that our client is, you know, a developer, not necessarily a municipality or a larger community, where the developer doesn't necessarily have it in their budget to go through an entire community engagement process. And when that happens, that can be really challenging, because we're looking to engage the community. We are looking to give the community what they want in their place. But when the developer is your client, you also have to weigh, okay, what does the market research say? What are the studies that are coming out, and how do we give our client what they need and what they want? So when we come into that situation, it's definitely a matter of looking at what can we learn from the community even in that sort of situation. But that is definitely something that we do deal with.
And just kind of the back end of his email, Ashley, he says, you know, how do you balance job security and values? I mean, do you find yourself thinking as your career progresses that there would be times where you would kind of put a foot down and say, you know, I've got enough capital with this that I can spend some, and say, we're not going to do it this way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is the thing that we do always try to do, even when we're working with private developers who may not necessarily have an entire public process in their line items, is we talk about why that would be important, how it can really make everything easier and better for them as they run through their whole process. And so that's definitely something, and there have also been times where, you know, I definitely know that I would, and I see it in my firm all the time, where people put their foot down when a project conflicts with their values.
Okay. Professor Ando?
Absolutely. I would say that there is a little bit of a compromise game being played, meaning that people will tell you, you kind of need to do this in order to be able to afford to do something else for someone else. And so you tend to compromise a little bit on trying to get much more exclusive luxury projects done to think about the other side. Maybe you might include 2-4% affordable housing in those projects, things like that, just always trying to compromise. But when you see the scales being tipped all the time in the favor of that exclusivity, that is when you kind of just need to put your foot down a little bit.
And so, Professor, I'm going to extend the theme from Brennan's email, and I appreciate a student at UB asking this kind of a question, because I think what I'm hearing in the email is, you know, am I entering a field where I'm going to feel like I'm compromising my values a lot?
It doesn't have to be that way, because you do have a voice. Clients will listen to you occasionally, and you will also bring in some perspective. So a case in point, my students work a lot here in Rochester. We engage with developers all the time, and they come in with a very strong sense of what they want to do. And working on a project where it would have displaced some people and places they eat, the students can actually sit down and have a conversation and talk with the developer that, you know what, I am a student. I don't have that much money going to college, and this is where I eat, and putting this project here would displace my local establishment. So what can we do about that? So it brings in a different perspective, and being able to add that voice is absolutely valuable.
Okay. Ashley, would you tell the student that, you know, you as a student of color, you may be entering a field where you're going to have to make some hard choices or do some things that are not all that comfortable?
I definitely think there's, you know, a place where you'd have to make hard choices, but I absolutely think that one of the most important things is to know your voice and know where you stand, know the lines that you're willing to take and the lines that you're willing to cross. I think one of the really important things there's a narrative that we have of the evil developer that has come across through time. And I think something that's really important is these developers are people who can be talked to. And yes, there's a bottom line, and yes, there's money that we need to figure out, and yes, there's a pro forma to figure out exactly how much we can afford and what we can afford to do, but there's a level of compromise and a level of understanding where the developer is coming from so that we can look at things that would mutually benefit both the developer and the community. And I think looking for those creative solutions is what makes a great design professional, as they can marry those two things together.
It sounds like you think that caricature of the evil developer is a little over the top, Ashley.
I do, partially because most of our clients, well, I don't know if most right now, but a large percentage of our clients are developers who really deeply care about what their projects will do, how they'll affect the community, and really want to have a successful project. And being hated by the community does not a successful project make.
How do you feel about that, Professor Ando?
I feel exactly the same way, that we have a new breed of developers coming up now that I would call enlightened, if you will, and they're looking to create things for the public good. In the end, yes, they do need to make ends meet and have a project that nets a profit, but they're willing to not see, you know, 200% returns in profit just for the public good.
All right, back to the phone calls. This is Bonnie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. It's I only caught the part of the end of this, but it's always good to hear your guests talk about supporting the community, because the neighborhoods, because I think you probably realize by now that over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of pushback from neighborhoods over what was traditionally in this city and many others is you do what we tell you, makes money, and then you should shut up. That's beginning to really, really change. So that's a good thing. It's a good thing to hear that people in professional areas get that also. So, but here's my other reason for going, is that there's a place off of on St. Paul and Avenue E that's where the old Hawkeye, I don't know how much everybody there knows about all this, but the old Hawkeye Kodak, it's a huge building. It was been vacant for years and years and years. Finally, somebody bought it. And so, again, our neighborhood group is trying to become involved more in that. We've had some tension because, unfortunately, some of the city officials aren't always following through. We're working on it because we want to be at the table in the beginning. We don't want to be at the table at the end and say, oh, what do you want now? Oh, too bad. So what I'm also asking for, and you don't have to answer this right now, but the Design Center was helped us and work with us a lot with El Camino. So, hey, come back in and help us with this. This is a huge building. I know they want to do multiple things with it, but we need somebody like the Design Center. You know, of course, we don't have much money or anything, but we need that kind of thing. We have learned things, but we're not super experts, so we need that thing to bounce off. Something that's more independent, so we don't have to have, you know, these constant controls by people who are more interested in power than they are in community organizing.
Thank you, Bonnie. What do you think, Professor Onda?
I think it's a very great point. And typically for projects like that, what you need is an unbiased third party to come in and really take a look to see what the community needs and listen to their needs and then try to put that on paper. And it cannot be things that you wish. It needs to be backed by data, because what is going to happen is if you give a wishy-washy thing to a developer or even to a municipality, they're going to knock that down and tell you that doesn't work. So research needs to be done. You need to look at demographic data, businesses around, what would make a project work and what would be the most feasible use for that building, as opposed to, because there are oftentimes a community will say we need something, and it truthfully may be something they need, but it may not work. So what you need to do is absolutely go and do the research, find out if it is going to work, have the data to back it up before you propose it.
Okay. Ms. Walton, what do you think?
I absolutely agree that having a third party is extremely invaluable in this situation. In a lot of our work, even though we are based in Pittsburgh, the vast majority of our projects are actually not in the city of Pittsburgh. We travel for almost all of our projects. And what we have found is that gives us a bird's eye perspective of the politics, of the issues. We're able to step outside the things that may be dense and on the ground and see from the outside and engage the community from the perspective of someone coming in. It allows us to just be a little bit outside, and I think that that's the type of thing that's really important in this sort of situation, and also the type of thing that is important as you're going through absolutely having the data to back up what you want to do instead of just telling a developer, well, this is what the community wants. Mm-hmm. Because often what we find in those situations is that the thing that the community is saying they want may actually exist in a small distance away, or in a way that can be consolidated or revamped or configured that it works better for their needs, not necessarily something that needs to be created new. So it also helps to put together and to talk, to figure out what's going on all around, what's the analysis that needs to be done to see what are the holes that can be filled.
So Ashley Walton, our guest, who is coming to Rochester a week from tonight, next Wednesday, April 24th at 7 p.m. for an event with the Reshaping Rochester series. That's at Gleason Works Auditorium, talking about social equity and design. And if at the core of this, Ashley, is just a lack of diversity in the field, what are you doing to change that? Tell me about mentoring and the work that you're doing.
Well, I think that one of my favorite things to do, we told you a little bit earlier on the program that one of the first things I wanted to be was a teacher, even before I wanted to be an architect. And I think that that's something that became a huge part of my life and how I want it to extend throughout my career. We often get this mentality that the two things about mentorship that I think we often get wrong is, one, we feel like we need to be at a certain point in our career before we can mentor, and two, we often feel like we need to look like the people we want to mentor. This, while one can be helpful, not always is what we need. And all of my mentors, all of my mentors have been white men, except for probably about one. And so that's just because that's the makeup of my field, and that's what I had to work with. But I think that the work that can do in mentorship is really remembering that don't have to be a mid-career or late-career professional to mentor. We already have stories. We each already have stories that we can share. The work that I'm doing personally is a lot of stuff with the National Organization of Minority Architects, which is a group that I'm happily involved with, especially the Pittsburgh chapter. And last year we held our first annual Project Pipeline Architecture Summer Camp. And Project Pipeline is a program of the National Organization of Minority Architects that focuses on introducing minority youth to architecture. And so it's usually the camps range from being two-day camps to week-long camps in different cities. And they're all about getting students involved with projects and getting them to meet minority professionals that are already in their areas.
Professor Onda, what do you think about pulling more people into the profession?
we just need to make ourselves as visible and available as possible. So anytime a speaking opportunity comes up, when you get invited to go to a high school, when you get a chance to show kids around a project or in your office or school, we just try to take full advantage of it, because you never know that 10-second handshake you have with someone might be what influences and changes their minds to say, you know what, this might be something that I might be geared to be able to do.
Are you optimistic that the field is going to change at all? 10 years from now, what do you think it's going to look like?
I think it is going to change because of exposure. I am on a diversity committee task force trying to take a look at how to engage more minorities to get into the profession. We're trying to do scholarships and a summer camp to see how we can really engage the youth to see architecture, because architecture and architect sounds romantic and it sounds expensive and almost unattainable. So to give a human face to it and to make it more of a humble profession as opposed to an exalted one.
Well, they're going to see you as a professor, and they're going to see that your work is influencing. I mean, I know you've done work around the world. You're doing work in our community right now in Rochester. They're going to be able to see up close the kind of research and questions that are being answered here. Some of the work in Rochester on adaptive reuse, yes? Tell us about that.
Yes. So what we try to do is we take a look at any community with a building worth saving. We work with the Landmark Society to identify buildings that are landmarks that have gone out of use, and we try to bring them back to life. And a perfect example is the Spaghetti Warehouse building on I think, is Central Avenue. And working with the community around there to say, you know what, we have a homeless crisis and population here in Rochester. So why not take a look at this building that is currently being used for storage and it's got gray bones? Why not turn it into maybe transitional housing? And so that is a project that my students took on. And we're now going to be working with DePaul Developers and Crystal Construction to hopefully be able to bring this project to fruition.
Let me get another question from a listener who asks, what is the role of sustainability, a pillar of which is equity? Do your guests find themselves educating clients or other stakeholders on sustainability? Ashley, go ahead.
Something really important to remember about sustainability is that a big part of sustainability is lovability of a building. If we love a building and we are willing to protect it, it is something that's a huge aspect of sustainability. That is, like, when you talk about buildings as they're going through a future, you know that an existing building is already going to be more green because it already exists, the embodied energy is already there, than building a new building, even the most highly, you know, certified, LEED certified sustainable building. Being able to work with adaptive reuse and working with buildings that are already loved and lovable is an absolute pillar of sustainability that we often forget.
Okay. Professor?
And I will say that social equity, when it comes to sustainability, is absolutely critical. And when it comes to buildings, it really impacts the urbanism of that building. So what I mean by that is you need to have buildings that people can use every day, but also be part of a community. So if you design the greenest building and it's out in the middle of nowhere and people have to always drive or can't even find a way to get to it, it doesn't make it as sustainable and as socially equitable. So social equity should mean doing affordable housing in urban contexts and having people be able to afford to live there, work there, play there, pray there, eat there, sleep there, all within a day. And that would be a socially equitable place.
All right, down to our last couple of minutes. And so I'll ask Ashley Walton to give us some of your final thoughts as we look into, you know, maybe the next generation of not only designers, but what our communities are going to look like. How do you think we're going to see communities change, whether it's how transportation is happening, whether it's how we're redesigning, how we lay out communities, housing or otherwise? What do you think the big changes are that are on the horizon, or maybe that you hope are on the horizon?
We definitely already see the demographics of communities changing pretty dramatically. If you look at 0 to 4-year-olds right now in the United States, the percentage of people who identify themselves as white has dropped by about 10% in just, you know, from current overall demographics to 0 to 4-year-olds. So we're already looking at especially large cities that are considered minority or majority minority populations. So I think that's something that's going to change. It's just how cities look in terms of the people who are in them are going to look different. But in terms of the actual physical things that I think are on the horizon, there's a lot of discussion about autonomous vehicles and things like that. But I think something that we're going to see a lot more immediately and things that we're already seeing is a big revolution in micromobility, so small-scale ability to get around. We're seeing it in a big way in electric bicycles, in small electric scooters, and in other methods of micromobility that are becoming increasingly common, and there's a lot of debate and discussion about it. But I think that these ways of being able to take people further with less energy are going to change how we deal with the last mile when we deal with public transit and things like that. I think micromobility is going to really change and shape how we see our cities.
Very interesting. About 40 seconds. Go ahead.
Sure. I would say that where we invest our money in developing is going to change. And what I mean is we typically invest in roads a lot, and that means that people are going to drive, and that is not socially equitable. So what we're going to see is more investment in biking and in walking to try to create more pedestrian-friendly environments and public transportation and investing our money in that so that that becomes the norm as opposed to the exception.
Fascinating stuff from our guest this hour. And I want to remind our listeners, if you want to meet Ashley Walton and listen to her presentation that is free and open to the public, they do suggest a $10 donation, and it is a week from tonight. So next Wednesday, April 24th, 7 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium. It's part of the Community Design Center's Reshaping Rochester series, and they'd love it if you registered in advance. It's rrcdc.org. Ashley Walton, we appreciate the time, and we'll see you in Rochester in a week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan.
And Professor Nana Ando is a professor of architecture at RIT and a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. Wonderful having your insight as well. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Don McDonald volunteering and Rob Braden engineering, Megan Mack producing. I'm Evan Dawson hosting. And we're going to be doing that all again tomorrow. Hope you'll join us on member-supported public radio.